way government regains the trust of its citizens is by telling the truth. There is no other way. No shortcut.
I call upon our government to open up like the Belgians have, the French have, Brazilians have, the Argentines, the Mexicans have all released their files. It's about time now that we do the same thing and become a part of this planetary community.
It is way past time for all of us to know what our own government knows, instead of being kept in the dark by a policy of denial.
The last time the Congress held a hearing addressing the extraterrestrial issue was 1968, 44 years of sightings ago. In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced, thousands of books have been written, and yet the United States Congress has remained silent. So for a period of 5 days, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House, 12 blocks from the Congress of the United States, we're going to conduct a citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. 40 to 50 witnesses of high rank and station, from military, from agencies, possibly from intelligence services, along with the top researchers in the world, will give 30 hours of testimony to 5 former members of the United States Congress.
So maybe the citizens' hearing has a chance to try to leverage open some of the truth about the fact that we're not alone in this universe, that we might actually begin to look at what we really are, what the true history of this planet is. And that might be what gets us into a future without self-destruction.
The model of the citizen hearing is if Congress won't do its job, the people will.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable. Countdown to Disclosure. I'm a little bit sleepy this morning. So, when I was trying to figure out what to do for today, I wanted to bring in a little bit of history. On this program, we've been reviewing each one of the witnesses that will be at the citizens' hearing, and we've been focusing on one person a day and doing some other things in a meditation. Well, today, I want to look back at what happened 11 years ago. You all know that on April 22nd, Dr. Stephen Greer of the Disclosure Project is going to release his film, The Sirius, the movie, the documentary. It will be based on his large body of work. And what many people don't know is that back on May 9th, 2001, Dr. Greer had a presentation at the National Press Club by many witnesses, and they came before everybody and said what they knew about the truth embargo. And yesterday we had an interview with Stephen Bassett, and he said there won't be, at the citizens' hearing, there won't be any witnesses regarding having had contact. And the ones that Stephen Greer had, most of them had contact. That was back in 2001. And this set of witnesses that I'd like us to look at is, their story isn't being told this time. But what I think is interesting is that after they all came forward at the press club together 11 years ago, 4 months later, we had 9/11. And we had the postponement of the announcements of Nasara Law that morning. So I think it's very important that we go back and hear these witnesses. Their testimony is so compelling. It's very moving to watch. And this is a 2-hour presentation, and I want us to do this for the sake of history for the next 2 days, today and tomorrow. And so I know that you're going to enjoy this very much. So I'm just going to jump right in and get started today. Thank you for this.
Years ago, the great screen actor Jimmy Cagney was working with a young actress that was about to be fired. He went to the director and said, "Let me talk to her." And he walked over to the actress and he said, "Look, it's simple. You walk in the room, you plant your feet, look me in the eye, and tell the truth." The logo of the X-Files is "The truth is out there. The truth is out there." I'm going to paraphrase. The truth is in here. You're about to hear the truth. I'm an actor. My name is John Cypher. For 7 years, I walked through the door, planted my feet, and tried to tell the truth as Chief Daniels on Hill Street Blues, as General Craig on the hit sitcom Major Dad. I was 2 years on Dynasty. You're on Knots Landing. I've done 5 afternoon soap operas, 12 Broadway shows, and 20 films. One of the Broadway shows I did was the great musical Man of La Mancha on Broadway. I was Richard Connelly's original understudy. I sang the words to dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, to bear with unbearable sorrow, to run where the brave dare not go. I'm here to introduce your host this morning, Dr. Stephen Greer. He's a man who is running pell-mell where the brave dare not go. He was an emergency room physician. In fact, the director of emergency medicine at a major hospital in North Carolina. 3 years ago, he sat his wife and his 4 daughters down and said, "I've been doing this part-time, running after the truth, for 7 years now. Now I'm going to do it full time." He walked away from all that money to pursue the truth. I always think of Hamlet's great line to Horatio: "There are more things between heaven and hell than are dreamed of in your philosophy, Horatio." I'm going to introduce a man who says, "There are more things between heaven and hell than any of us have accepted. And I have the witnesses and the documents to prove it." Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Stephen Greer.
Thank you very much, John. Members of the press, the American public, and people of the world. We are here today to disclose the truth about a subject that has been ridiculed and questioned, denied for at least 50 years. The men and women who are on this stage and the some 350 additional military intelligence witnesses to the so-called UFO matter and extraterrestrial intelligence can prove and will prove that we are not alone. I would like to thank Sarah McClendon, who is with us today, the famed White House correspondent, for her sponsorship of this meeting. Thank you very much, Sarah. In 1993, a group of military advisors to this project and I met out in the countryside in Virginia. And we decided that it was time for civilians, military, intelligence, and other people to come together to disclose the truth about the subject which is called UFOs. Since that time, I have personally briefed a sitting director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey, President Clinton's first CIA director. I have personally briefed the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, the head of Intelligence Joint Staff, members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, many members of Congress, members of the European leadership, the Japanese cabinet, and others. And what I have found is that none of them are surprised that this is true, but they are uniformly horrified that they have not had access to these projects. We can establish through these witnesses whom we have identified, which now number over 400, and these are people who have been inside the CIA, NSA, NRO, Air Force, Navy, Marines, Army, all divisions of the intelligence and military community, as well as corporate witnesses, contractors to the government. And these are folks who have been involved in so-called black budget or covert unacknowledged projects. These unacknowledged special access projects are taking in at least $40 to $80 billion per year. And they are sitting on technologies that can change the world forever. The reason we are coming forward now is that we are asking for the U.S. Congress and for President Bush to move towards an official inquiry and disclosure on this subject. It has the most profound implications for the human future, for the U.S. national security, and for world peace. Specifically, technologies connected to UFO and extraterrestrial vehicles, if declassified and used for peaceful energy generation and propulsion, would solve the looming energy crisis definitively, would end global warming, would correct the environmental challenges that the Earth is facing. It is also critical that we begin to debate as a society the propriety of placing weapons in space. If indeed, as we can prove, it is true that we are not alone and that space is territory which we are sharing with other civilizations, it could be a very imprudent, destabilizing thing to place weapons in space. This is not being debated because it is off the national and international radar screens. It needs to be placed on it, and we are here today to do it. We can establish through this testimony that these objects of extraterrestrial origin have been tracked on radar going thousands of miles per hour, stopping and making right-hand turns, that they use anti-gravity propulsion systems, which we have already figured out how they work in classified projects in the United States, Great Britain, and elsewhere, that these objects have landed on terra firma, at times have been disabled, and have been retrieved specifically by teams within the United States, that extraterrestrial life forms have been retrieved, and their vehicles have been taken and studied thoroughly for at least 50 years. We can prove through the testimony and documents that we will be presenting that this subject has been hidden from members of Congress and at least two administrations that we are aware of, presidential administrations, and that the Constitution of the United States has been subverted by the growing power of these classified projects, and that this is a danger to the national security. There is no evidence, I wish to emphasize, that these life forms from elsewhere are hostile towards us, but there is a great deal of evidence that they are concerned with our hostility. There are times when they have neutralized or rendered inert the launch capabilities of intercontinental ballistic missiles. Witnesses here today will describe those events to you. They have shown clearly that they do not want us to weaponize space, and yet we are proceeding down that dangerous path. And it will be established that these projects, because they have not been supervised properly by the Congress, by the U.S. President, by the international community, have become a threat to the national security. And for this reason, we feel we must disclose the facts. This is the beginning of the campaign for disclosure. And in a memo that I wrote to President Bush last week, I've stated that this campaign will persist until our goals are met, and they are as follows. That we have open, honest hearings on the subject in the U.S. Congress. That there be a permanent ban on the weaponization of space or the targeting of any objects of extraterrestrial origin. that there be a full and complete study of classified technologies connected to this subject to see how they could be properly declassified and applied for peaceful energy generation so that the world may get off of fossil fuels in enough time to prevent greater ecosystem damage or war over the looming energy crisis, which is sure to sweep the earth in the coming decade. This is a matter of the most pressing import. It has been ridiculed, yes. I know many in the media would like to talk about little green men. But in reality, the subject is laughed at because it is so serious. I have had grown men weep who are in the Pentagon, who are members of Congress, and who have said to me, what are we going to do? Here's what we will do. We will see that this matter is properly disclosed. And these courageous witnesses, the first 21 of over 100 that we have already interviewed on videotape, have stepped forward to speak the truth. Now, I expect people to be skeptical, but not irrationally so, because these men and women have come forward and they have their credentials, they can establish who they are, and they have been firsthand witnesses to some of the most important events in the history of the human race. As was pointed out to me by some of the men here, they were charged with handling the nuclear weapons of the United States. Their word was trusted on everything of great importance for the national security. We must trust their word now. As Monsignor Balducci said at the Vatican, in an interview I had with him recently, it is irrational not to accept the testimony of these witnesses. So please be skeptical, but that is not the same as prejudiced and closed-minded. This is a matter of great importance, and I ask the media, the scientific community, and the political community to look seriously at this matter and to do the right thing for humanity and for our children. We have available for the media and for members of Congress a nearly 500-page briefing document with transcripts from dozens of these top-secret witnesses. We have a 4-hour videotape summary. It's not a commercial product, I warn you, from this project of the 120 hours that we have in interviews so far. They've been boiled down to 4 hours, and it's available for the Congress to review and for the major media to review. We can establish that this subject is real and has tremendous significance for the human future. I ask on all of you who are listening to contact the members of Congress that represent you and the leaders around the world and other countries and ask them to hold an honest inquiry into this subject to support a ban on weaponizing space, since we are sharing space with other life forms, and that we move quickly as a people to understanding that this is the end of the childhood of the human race. It is time for us to become mature adults in the cosmic civilizations out there. To do this, we must become a peaceful civilization, and we must look as we go into space with an intent of cooperating with other civilizations, not weaponizing that high frontier. The men and women who will speak next will do so in order, beginning on your left. They will introduce themselves. I ask for the media to refrain from questions until each witness has spoken briefly about who they are and what they have personally been involved with or witnessed in their government, military, or government-connected careers. At the end, we will have questions. All of you may ask questions for as long as we can stay here, and we will provide you with all the information that you need. So we will begin now with the first of our witnesses, Mr. John Callahan.
My My name is John Callahan. I'm a retired FAA employee. I was the division manager for the Accidents Evaluation and Investigation Division in D.C. About 2 years before I retired, I received a call from Alaska region where the region wanted to know what to tell the media. When I questioned, tell the media what, he says about the UFO, and it went downhill from there. What UFO? It turned out I told him what any government employee would do at that time was to tell him it's under investigation. And then I had him send all that data to the FAA's tech center in Atlantic City. The next day, my immediate boss, service director, Javi Safir, and I went to Atlantic City. I just purchased a new video camera, and I videoed the event. In Atlantic City, we had them play back on a scope, you would call it a scope, a planned view display, PVD, exactly what the pilot seen or what the controller seen, and we tied that in with the voice tape so we could hear exactly what the controller said and what he heard, and we taped it. We came back the next day, briefed the administrator, Admiral Ingen, on what happened. He wanted a five-minute briefing. After we started the briefing, he wanted to know if he could see the video. We put the video on. He watched the video, the whole video. The next day, he set up a meeting for me to give a dog and pony show to President Reagan's scientific staff and whoever they brought over, and to hand off all that data to them. That morning in the FAA round room, it was either 9 or 10 o'clock, three men from Reagan's scientific staff, three CIA people, three FBI people, and I don't remember who the other guys were, along with all the FAA experts that I brought with me that could decide or talk about the hardware and software, how it worked. We put on a dog and pony show. We let them watch the video. We had all the data there. We had all the printouts that the computer put out. They got all excited over it. When it was all done, the CIA, one of the CIA men told the people they were now sworn to secrecy, that this meeting never happened and this event never happened. When I asked them why, I thought it was probably just a stealth bomber at the time. He says, well, this is the first time that we have recorded radar data on a UFO, and these guys are going to get all excited, drooling over all this data. I said, well, you're going to tell the public about it. And he says, no, we don't tell the public about this. It would panic the public. He says, we're going to go back and study this. I said, okay, it was what he was going to do. Now, I've told this story many times, and I get sometimes funny looks from people. I have with me the voice tapes of the controllers that were involved, the FAA original tapes. See, after we handed this stuff off to the president's staff, the FAA didn't know what to do with it. We don't separate UFOs from real traffic, so it's not our problem. Okay. I have a copy of the original of the video that we took, which is rather interesting. And once the thing was all over, the report started coming into my office, but because it wasn't an FAA air traffic problem, the FAA's report ended up on a table in my office. And it stayed there until I retired when one of the staffers packed up all my gear and helped it move to my house. Also, in a box I found just a few days ago in my 1992 tax return, I have the target printouts from the computer data, which so if you wanted to or look at every target that was up there at the time, you can now reproduce this from this piece of paper here. And it's called the UFO Incident, Japan 1648, I believe the number was, that happened on November the 18th, 1986. I'm prepared to go to Congress, to swear before Congress, that everything I've told you people and everything that is here is the truth. Thank you.
Good morning. I hope you'll pardon me. I'm a little bit nervous. My name is Charles L. Brown. I'm a Lieutenant Colonel of the U.S. Air Force, retired, subsequently 7 years with the Foreign Service. I like the name Charlie Brown, a gentleman by the name of Charles Schultz, of great talent, sort of elevated the name, if you will. During World War II, I was a young farm boy from West Virginia. I got the patriotic bug, joined the United States Army, ended up flying bombers in Europe, and ended the war transport in the Pacific. Finished college in the summer, late summer of 49, recalled to active duty in the newly formed United States Air Force. I was assigned to an organization called Office of Special Investigations. The Air Force, as most of you know, was formed in 1947. OSI, as a central investigative agency for the Air Force, was formed, I think, in 1948. So everything was relatively new. Needless to say, starting in 47, UFOs were rather new. The Air Force Intelligence, or Air Technical Intelligence Center, was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and I had my office in a building adjacent to it. And our organization was the worldwide investigative agency for the Air Force for any unidentified flying objects. This lasted for about 2 years. The project name was known as Project Grudge. It was a predecessor to a project known as Blue Book, which Andrew Pelt headed. During my experience with it, I would collect the data from around. I didn't collect it. It was sent into my office. I analyzed it. As a pilot investigator, I was able to offer some bits of advice to the air technical intelligence people. Now, you might visualize a massive office, but as I recall, we had a first lieutenant, a secretary, and a technical sergeant. That was the essence of Project Blue Book when we started, Project Grudge. Blue Book and expanded somewhat. During the review as an analyst of these various documentary reports, if you will, or documents, I became clearly convinced that there was substance to what was being reported, in that we had ground visual, ground radar, airborne visual, and airborne radar confirmation of some of these sightings. The individuals who made the sightings were everything from airline pilots, military pilots, police officers, some of the people that your lives depend upon on a daily basis. These are very reputable and credible people. I hope that the testimony here from very credible people will convince you of that and will further Steve Greer's disclosure project, in that pressure needs to be brought to bring this to the attention not only of the Americans, but of people all over the planet. These vehicles have been seen and confirmed all over the planet. I am willing to sign a sworn statement or testify to my judgment and to what I have observed. Such things do exist. Please believe me. Please believe those who follow me. Thank you.
My name is Michael Smith. I was in the Air Force, a sergeant, from 1967 to 1973. I was aircraft control and warning operator. While I was assigned to Klamath Falls, Oregon, in early 1970, I arrived at the radar site, and they were watching a UFO on a radar that was hovering at about 80,000 feet. It sat there for about 10 minutes and then slowly descended until it dropped off the radar. It was gone for about 5-10 minutes, and then instantly reappeared at 80,000 feet, stationary. The next sweep of the radar, it was 200 miles away, stationary. It hovered there for about 10 minutes and redid the whole cycle twice more. When I found out what the what you normally do when you see a UFO, I was told that in order to find NORAD, you don't necessarily write anything down. You don't write anything down. And you keep it to yourself. It's a need-to-know basis only. And NORAD one night called me about later in the year to let me know as a heads up that there was a UFO coming up the California coastline. I asked them what I should do about this. They said, nothing. Don't write it down. It's just a heads up. And then late 1972, while stationed at 753rd Radar Squadron in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, I received a couple of panicky calls from police officers who were chasing three UFOs from Mackinac Ridge up I-75. So I immediately checked the radar, confirmed that they were there, called NORAD, and they were concerned because they had two inbound B-52s going to Kinsella Air Force Base. So they diverted them because they didn't want any proximity of the two. And that night I answered many calls from the police department, sheriff's department and stuff. And my standard response was that there was nothing on radar. And I will testify to this under oath to a congressional hearing.
Good morning. My name is Enrique Kolbeck. I am a traffic controller. I'm sorry for my English. I'm so scared. I'm not accustomed to talking in front of a lot of people. I'm here because I'm being a witness in a voluntary way on my work. I work in Mexico City as radar controller and the International Airport of Mexico. And I'm going to give an example about this sinus that we have in Mexico for several years, and this issue happens a lot of times in my country, unfortunately. For example, in March 4, 1992, we detected 15 objects west side of the Toluca Airport, that is very close of our international airport, at 50 miles more or less. Then July 28, 1994, we have almost a collision or something that we can name in that way with an international flight, I mean a domestic flight of Aeroméxico 129, commanded by the pilot Raimundo Cervantes Ruano, that has a trash or something about in his main landing gear in the right leg. That's occurred, right? At 10:30, more or less. Then, in the next week, the same year, in the same moment, the Aeroméxico Flight 904 has another almost collision that was reported for the pilot Corso, the Captain Corso, at 11:30 in the morning, and we detect that object on a radar. Suddenly, just for a moment. Then, in the next week, we have a lot of sightings reported by the pilots that give us information about the weird traffic or something, bright lights, and different times. And we detect some of them in that week. But then, September 15 of 1994, we have a detection about 5 hours, more or less, on a radar and a new equipment that we believe that that equipment was working in not a good way, because it's not human that you have detection by 5 hours of the same object and apparently without movement. Well, we concur with the technical persons of radar in our country that the radar system was working well, and was very exciting, and we surprised when at the next day we received information about a periodist named Jaime Maussan that is studied these cases in Mexico, about that sighting a lot from a lot of people in the Metepec city. There is another point located southeast of the Toluca Airport, about a sighting of the big flying saucer, apparently 15 meters of diameter. Then for a lot of people, and that led the trash or something in the ground. Well, next, in November 24, 1994, we have on service officially our new radar system. And after that moment, we have information very exactly about of these sightings at the same time with the pilots and detections. That's why I'm here, because we consider in my country that this is very dangerous. We have a lot of more cases, but I don't want to use more time in this. But it's very important that the people on the world knows these events and consider that could be very dangerous for aeronautical situation, especially in my country. I don't know why in my country that's occurred frequently, but the point is that happens, and we consider dangerous, and we have some the unfortunately one trash, but we don't want to have another one. Thank you very much, and I'm sorry for my.
My name is Graham Bethune. I'm a retired Navy commander, pilot, had a top secret clearance. 50 years ago, February the 10th, 1951, I was flying from Keflavik, Iceland to Argentia, Newfoundland. It was at night. It was dark. About 300 miles outside of Argentia, I saw a glow on the water, like approaching a city at night. As we approached this glow, it turned to a monstrous circle of white lights on the water. We watched this for a while. The lights went out. There was nothing on the water. Next thing we saw was a yellow halo, small, much smaller than whatever it was launched from. And that was 15 miles away, up to our altitude. Because of the trajectory, I disengaged the autopilot, shoved the nose over to try to go under this thing. And at that time, I heard a noise underneath. I thought maybe it hit us. It was actually some of the crew members ducking, and they collided, and a couple of them were injured. Then it appeared over to the right and moved out slowly and flew with us. It was still not at our altitude, but we could see the shape of it. It had a dome. We could see the coronal discharge. I went back aft, let the other pilot, Al Jones, take my seat to see what the passenger's reaction was. Came back to the cockpit, told him not to report anything, simply because what that psychiatrist had said to me, maybe they would lock us up. So basically, the instruments in the cockpit, we had four or five failures in the area of magnetic compass, you know, the electromagnetic effect, in the area of directional finders, and this type of thing. The craft was tracked by radar in excess of 1,800 miles an hour. It never did get to our altitude. We had 31 passengers, plus the psychiatrist and the crew members, that all sighted this at different areas. When we landed at Argentia, Newfoundland, we were interrogated by the Air Force, an excellent interrogation, Captain Paulson. When we landed at the Naval Air Test Center here at Patuxent River, we were required by Navy intelligence to make out individual reports. Out of the National Archives, I have the 18-page official Navy and Air Force report. I've made up a report to straighten out all the truth. There's a stack of books out there this high that have written all of this up. So the truth is here. I will testify under oath before Congress that everything that I have said is true.
My name is Dan Willis. I was in the United States Navy. I held a top secret crypto level 14 extra sensitive material handling security clearance. I worked in the code room at the Naval Communication Station in San Francisco. In 1969, I received a priority message from a ship near Alaska that was classified as secret. The ship reported merging out of the ocean near Port Bow, a brightly glowing reddish-orange elliptical object approximately 70 feet in diameter emerged out of the water, shot into space, traveling at about 7,000 miles per hour. This was tracked on ship's radar and substantiated. Years later, I worked at the Naval Electronic Engineering Center in San Diego for 13 years. The co-worker who I worked with worked at the NORAD facility. When he first started working at the facility, he noticed objects going on the screens to track everything out in space and in the air. Objects going off the scale, doing right-angle turns. When he inquired, his older supervisor advised him that, quote, it was just a visit from one of our little friends. I thought this was a little unusual. These statements are true and willing to testify under oath before Congress. Thank you.
My name is Don Phillips. I was in the United States Air Force and had worked with certain intelligence agencies of the United States government. Prior to joining the Air Force, I worked for the famous Lockheed Skunk Works. And I was working for them when I was attending college, and I worked for them in the capacity as a design engineer. It was one of my proudest moments of my life to work with a man by the name of Kelly Johnson. A lot of you might be familiar with that. It turns out that the models of aircraft that we were building, as you know, were all classified, were in the deep black, and that I came in on the end of the U-2 project. My main project was known later as the SR-71. The SR-71 had a predecessor. It had a special model built for the CIA, and that those models were one passenger, one pilot, special aircraft in order to get from one place to another very, very quickly. Now, these SR-71s, as we know them, the Blackbird, are the type of aircraft that are still classified in a sense as far as the altitude that it flies at and also the speed records that it holds. I'm very proud to say that this aircraft played a big part in helping to end the Cold War. The aircraft, the predecessor aircraft, there's strong evidence to suggest that perhaps these aircraft had a different role once in the air. Each pilot, and I knew a few of them, each pilot had an assignment before they took off. They learned about the assignment immediately prior to takeoff, and there's strong evidence to suggest that there was a dual role in that they were monitoring some type of traffic to and from planet Earth. This can be verified at a later point. I'll jump into my military experience. My first field assignment for the United States Air Force was at Las Vegas Air Force Station. And that was my first experience with Las Vegas, and I couldn't understand why people were being so excited about going to a place such as this, but I soon found out about a year later. Nellis Air Force Base is located there. Nellis is a major training center for different types of special aircraft and fighter aircraft, one of the premier training sites for pilots all around the world. However, when I learned that my assignment was at a radar site 50 miles out of town, up near Mount Charleston, I had no idea where I'd be. So finally in the daylight, I was able to find the location and reported in 1965 for duty. In 1966, early in the morning, about 1 to 2 a.m., I was staying there on base, and our barracks were at about 8,000 feet. I heard a lot of commotion. You know, at that altitude, sound carries tremendously. And I thought, well, it's early in the morning, it's summertime, and there is a lot, it's very warm, and maybe I should get up and take a look. I didn't really want to, but I got up, took a look, walked up to the main road up near my office, which was the commander's office. I was on the commander's staff, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Evans. And I was saying, who's making all this noise? Who's making all this noise at this time of the morning? So when I got within about 50 yards of the four or five people that were standing there, one being the chief of security, they were looking up in the air, and I says, gee, their heads are all looking at the same direction. Well, I looked up to the west, northwest, and to my amazement, there were lights flashing around the sky, moving at anywhere from what seemed like 2,400 to about 3,800 miles per hour. Now, the fact that we're taking an estimate from a distance, you know, we figured, well, this is quite something. However, we continue to watch these darting lights go across the sky and stop, absolutely stop, come to a dead stop and reverse in an acute angle their direction, and then proceed on in sort of, they were traveling so fast that you could almost see a pattern left by, if you are computer people, when you move a mouse real quick across the screen, you see a little bit of a tail. Well, that's exactly the way these six or seven craft work. After 5 minutes of watching these things, they all seem to group up to the west, northwest. Okay? They started to come in on a circle. But what I would like to point out is that where they were putting on their display in the north-northwest sky, just directly east of that is what is known as Area 51. Area 51 is a AEC name, okay? Atomic Energy Commission. That was the old name for Atomic Energy Commission. We knew it as the Groom Lake Flight Test Facility in the Air Force. And it was where we tested our aircraft after we got the prototype made from the Skunk Works. So here are these, let's get back to the circle in the sky. What they did was coalesce and started rotating in a circle, and then they disappeared. Well, I thought, gee, this is something that we have to keep quiet. That was verified by the chief of security. But we waited there and talked it over for a little bit. It seemed like, I think it was an hour. Then came the radar people from the scopes, which were at 10,000 plus feet, came down for their dinner at 2 o'clock in the morning. And the first person off the bus was a good friend of mine, Anthony Kasar. He said, he was white as a sheet. And he says, did you see that? Yeah, we all said, yeah, it was a nice display. What a show. He says, we documented them on radar. And he says, we didn't give them clearance. We just, the standing order was let them fly through the radar beam. He says, we documented 6 to 7 UFOs. Now, we don't know who was guiding those, but they were certainly intelligent. And we don't know where they landed because they coalesced and disappeared. So I will say at this point, to keep it short, that I will testify under oath as to what I say is true, and I will do so before Congress. Thank you.
My name is Robert Solis. Contrary to what it says on the card, I was not a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. I was in the Air Force active duty after I graduated from the Air Force Academy in 1964 until 1971 and separated as a captain. In March of 1967, I was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana, as a missile launch officer, Minuteman missiles. On an early morning of March 16th, 1967, I got a call from my security guard, primary security guard upstairs. We had about six, as I recall, flight security airmen upstairs. I was downstairs 60 feet underground in a capsule, monitoring and controlling 10 nuclear tipped Minuteman missiles. I got a call that morning that they were seeing strange lights flying in the sky. I disregarded that call. Told them to call me when something more significant happened. I got another call subsequent to that call, and this time it was a more intense tone in the guard's voice. It was very clearly very frightened. He said there was a bright, glowing red object hovering outside the front gate. It was oval-shaped. He had all the other guards out there with their weapons drawn. Right after that call, I woke up my commander, who was on a rest period, Fred Meiwald, a retired colonel now, and told him about the phone calls. As I was telling him about the phone calls, my weapons started going down one after the other. They went into a no-go condition, what we call no-go condition. They were unlaunchable. We lost somewhere between 6 and 8 weapons that morning within minutes of having received that second phone call of a UFO hovering outside the front gate. Again, that morning, after reporting it to the command post, we were informed that a very similar incident happened at Echo Flight. I was at Oscar Flight. They lost all 10 of their weapons under similar circumstances, very similar circumstances, where UFOs were sighted over the launch facilities. They had maintenance crews and security crews out there that had spent the night, and they were reporting UFOs over those sites. And the commander of that flight was Eric Carlson. He also separated as a captain, and the deputy commander was Walt Fiegel, retired as a lieutenant colonel. We have those witnesses that I just mentioned. The names I just mentioned have spoken of this event before, and they will back up this story. We also have documentation that I received through FOA requests from the Air Force outlining the Echo Flight incident, and including in that documentation a reference to UFOs. We have telexes covering this incident, and in one telex it says the fact that no apparent reason for the loss of 10 missiles can be readily identified is cause for grave concern to this headquarters. This was from SAC headquarters. So we've got those telexes. I've got about 12 witnesses that'll verify parts of this story, including of a man who investigated the incident afterwards for the Air Force. And you'll hear a little bit more about that from the next witness. And also another guard that witnessed a UFO in that same time period, and another officer, a retired full colonel, who had other reports of UFOs. Ancillary to that, I've got the complete report on a Minot, North Dakota incident. That was Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota, which happened in August of 1966. Very similar. UFOs sighted over missile silos, and also a UFO incident that was investigated by the Air Force immediately after our incident within a week. I'm willing to testify to the truth of all these matters that I've spoken about this in front of Congress under oath. Thank you.
My name is Dwayne Arneson. I served 26 years as a communication electronics officer in the U.S. Air Force, all over the world, including Vietnam. I was lucky to be selected to be commander of 3 different units in the Air Force. I held the top secret SCI TK clearance, and for those who don't know, it is slightly above top secret. I retired in 1986 as a colonel at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. I would like to relate about 3 different experiences, if you will, that relate to UFOs. As a young lieutenant over in Germany, Ramstein Air Base, Germany, back in the early 60s, I was in charge of the cryptographic center. I had a top secret crypto clearance at that time, and I can clearly recall seeing a message that went through my crypto center which said that a UFO had crashed on the island of Spitsbergen, Norway, and the team of scientists were coming to investigate it. Going forward to the 1967 time frame, I was assigned to the 28th Air Division at Great Falls, Montana, and I was the officer in charge of the communications center there. Also, I was a top secret control officer for the division. I had a crypto account. I was an account custodian, and I also passed out nuclear launch authenticators. During that time, I can recall seeing a message come through that communication center which said, basically what Bob was just got through talking about, is that a UFO was seen near the missile silos, and the missiles were deactivated. Coincidentally, the person that Boeing sent to investigate the particular missile conditions, if you will, what made them shut down, was my first manager at Boeing, Mr. Bob Kaminsky, who has since passed away. And I can recall him on different occasions. He lived close to me in Auburn, Washington. That's where I'm from. And he said, Arnie, he says, those missiles were perfectly clean. That was a result. So the one last incident concerned when I was as a commander of the unit in Great Falls, or in Caswell Air Force Station, Maine, I had contacts with the security police at Loring Air Force Base, and they told about UFOs that were seen near the nuclear weapon storage areas on Loring Air Force Base. And I'd be glad to testify to Congress that this is absolutely the truth. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Harlan Bentley. During 1957 and 1959, I was a PFC in the United States Army, stationed north of Washington, D.C., on a Nike Ajax missile base close to Olney, Maryland. In May, this month of 1958, about 6 a.m., I heard a noise outside. It sounded like a pulsating transformer. I sat up in my bunk. I looked out the window. I saw a craft heading for the ground and crashed. Pieces broke off of that craft, immediately took off again. So there's a lot more to that story, but I've got to speed this up. Now, the next night, I was on radar duty. I get a call from the Gaithersburg missile base. He says, hey, I got 12 to 15 UFOs outside, 50 to 100 feet above me. So I asked him, I said, what does it sound like? He took his head mic off, held it out the van window, and said, here. And the same sound I heard the previous morning, except a lot more of them. So my radar was on standby, so I immediately turned it on and got the blip just outside of the ground clutter. I marked it on my radar screen. And then for a few minutes later, all of a sudden they took off. As they took off, the sweep came around, hit the blip. The second, when it came around, it hit it again. That blip was two-thirds away off my radar scope. In order to get that far at a constant velocity was 17,000 miles an hour. That was my first incident. 10 years later, by this time I received a Bachelor of Science degree in electrical engineering, and I was working in California. Now, I'm sorry that all I can say is I was somewhere in California working on a classified project that had nothing to do with my experience that I had there. As I was working, and it was like 2 or 3 in the morning, California time, I heard a Houston astronaut communication link, comlink. I didn't pay much attention to it until I heard the word bogey. Of course, my ears picked up immediately, an unidentified flying object of some sort, whether it's a craft, meteorite, or whatever, was on a collision course with that module going to loop around the moon. So basically, I listened for some time, and then I stopped and went back to work. And then I heard, there they go. In the astronaut world, some of you may not know this, there's a term called green turtle. And it used to be, I don't know if it is today or not, but it used to be is you're not allowed to use profanity over the net. And the first person that does that, whoever hears it first and says green turtle, that astronaut's got to buy that man and his entire family a dinner at the most expensive place at Cape Canaveral. Well, to end this real quick, One of them said, damn, they went off, the UFOs took off. He says, damn, that was fast. And somebody yelled, green turtle. And then he said another word, a synonym to crap. And then somebody else yelled, green turtle. And you could see him grit his teeth, because now he had to buy two expensive meals. And my particular experience, I will testify before Congress if necessary, and explain exactly what happened. Thank you.
Okay, everybody, I want to hold it there. This is amazing stuff. This is what we're not going to see at the citizens' hearing. We're not going to do a repeat of this. But I want to emphasize that 4 months after they did this before, we had 9/11. This was in May, and we know that in June, President George W. Bush went to his ranch in Texas and stayed there for 91 days. He was absent from the White House. They were busy in the White House. Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Richard Myers, and many others. September 11th, 2001, we had 9/11. So I think it's important that we review this history. Thank you for being here with me today. Have a wonderful day. Please come back tomorrow. Namaste.